Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Beneath the Sands of Egypt, Adventures of an Unconventional Archaeologist by Donald P. Ryan. Narrated by Paul Bamer. Preface. I'm a fortunate fellow. Literally hundreds, if not thousands of times, people have told me that I'm doing something they wish they could do. I'm living their dream. Or part of it, anyway, they tell me. I've never figured out a good response to such comments. I've gone to fantastic places, worked with fascinating people, and discovered, as Howard Carter once put it, wonderful things. Sadly, society can't realistically sustain millions of archaeologists and Egyptologists, but I can at least attempt to share the adventure and perhaps educate, entertain, and even inspire. In this book, I hope to do all of these things, and if I'm lucky, I'll succeed in one or two of them. Yes, I've been involved in some pretty great stuff. Serendipity, coincidence, and meeting the right people have all played a role, but so have creativity, ingenuity, preparation, and initiative. Nothing ventured, nothing gained, they say, and I hope you enjoy my sharing of some of my adventures, focused mostly on Egypt, which is without doubt one of the most intriguing of all lands on this gorgeous planet. Chapter 1. The Tomb. The haunting melody of a Beethoven piano sonata played softly in the background as I gazed into the slit of darkness evolving before my eyes. I handed another small stone to Ahmed, who in turn handed it up the ancient white steps to be added to the growing pile of rubble. Beethoven would no doubt have been incredulous that his Appassionata served as the soundtrack for such a remarkable scene. The opening of an ancient Egyptian tomb in the famed Valley of the Kings. It was actually a reopening of this particular tomb, myself being perhaps the fourth person to have done so, I reckoned, over a period of over 3 millennia. As I carefully removed the stones, I marveled at the situation in which I found myself. Here I was, in the most famous archaeological site in the world, following in the footsteps of earlier explorers who were likewise entranced by this ancient place. The vertical limestone walls of the valley soared nearby, their golden hues becoming increasingly lighter due to the same intense summer sun that baked us as we worked in the vanishing late morning shade. What tales those cliffs could tell, having borne witness for centuries to episodes of passionate human drama, the sweat of ancient workmen, the tears of the bereaved, and now the drama of modern archaeological discovery. Approximately 3,400 years ago, one of the most powerful men on the planet, the mighty Pharaoh, lord of Upper and Lower Egypt, Akeperkere Thutmose, commanded that a secret tomb be constructed for his burial in the arid Theban Mountains. Unfortunately, the pyramids of his predecessors now stood only as towering beacons calling out to the treasure-minded and had proved to be utter failures when it came to protecting the remains of those considered to be god-kings. Thutmose had instigated a new strategy in the hope of better ensuring his eternal security by building a hidden tomb carved deep into the bedrock in a remote desert valley unseen by the masses, with an immense peak hovering nearby, whose natural shape provided a symbolic pyramid over the royal grave. Thutmose's tomb would initiate the Valley of the Kings as the burial place for three dynasties of rulers during the historical period referred to as the New Kingdom, which would span approximately 500 years from about 1500 to 1000 BC. It was the royal cemetery that was the stage for our unfolding tomb opening. Just a few minutes' walk from where we were lies the tomb of the famous warrior pharaoh Ramses II, and not far beyond, that of Tutankhamun, the obscure, short-lived king whose virtually intact tomb brought him lasting immortality in the modern world. And just a few dozen yards from our dig is the original tomb of Thutmose I, a deep, dangerous, subterranean sepulchre, expanded and later utilized by his daughter, the remarkable female pharaoh, Hatshepsut. The early tombs in the valley were well hidden, often in fissures in the cliffs or in other places easily concealed. Those of the later pharaohs typically boasted large, obvious entrances carved into the valley's limestone. The magnificently painted corridors that followed led to an imposing stone sarcophagus holding the mummy of the king. Like the pyramids, the Valley of the Kings too, in the long run, would prove to be a failure in guarding against the greedy. Many of its tombs would be robbed, even while the cemetery was still in use. As early as the 3rd century BC, several of the tombs were tourist attractions to Greek and Roman sightseers who came to marvel at the remains of the past, much as we do today. Many of them even left evidence of their visit in the form of graffiti, which can still be seen and read today, scrawled on the walls of several tombs. Some of the valley's tombs would later serve as austere housing for reclusive Christian hermits, and some would suffer the devastations of flash floods and other natural and human indignities. Ultimately, few of the pharaohs survived in their intended final resting places. Most of their ravaged mummies were gathered up by ancient priests, rewrapped, and stowed in secret caches where they have been rediscovered during the last century or so. Like most archaeology in Egypt, the Valley of the Kings has a rich history of exploration. Although the location of the valley was long known to European travelers, it wasn't until the arrival of Giovanni Belzoni in 1816 that excavations actually began in our modern era. More on him in another chapter. Then, in 1827, John Gardner Wilkinson wandered about the valley with a container of paint, boldly numbering each known tomb as he went along, and establishing a numbering system that provided a ready frame of reference for the scholars and archaeologists who followed. Although Wilkinson got only as far as the number 21, the system would eventually extend to 63, the number that has been assigned to the last new tomb discovered as of this writing, a bizarre cache of mummyless coffins, uncovered in 2006. While the Valley of the Kings is certainly one of the most celebrated sites of antiquity on Earth, most people, archaeologists included, are unaware that among the 30 or so beautifully decorated royal tombs lie an approximately equal number of typically small and uninscribed tombs, whose very presence in the valley actually bespeaks some sort of great importance. Some consist merely of a shaft leading to a single rectangular burial room, while others contain a corridor or two, and steps that eventually lead to a final chamber. These tombs, whose blank walls routinely render their deceased occupants anonymous, were until recently considered of little interest to Egyptologists. Readily identifiable art and writing on the walls of the bigger royal tombs are certainly alluring and have long attracted the majority of scholarly attention. The particular tomb we were currently excavating was nameless. It was simply known as Tomb 60, or KV 60, to use the King's Valley prefix, commonly appended by Egyptologists, to designate a tomb in the valley rather than tombs in other ancient Egyptian cemeteries. When English archaeologist Howard Carter stumbled across this tomb in the spring of 1903, he was unimpressed by its size, its lack of decoration, and its looted interior. Carter was looking for bigger and better things. Large royal tombs, for instance, with painted walls and nicely preserved artifacts. 19 years later, Carter would hit the archaeological jackpot when, on just the other side of the valley, he discovered the burial rooms of someone who has since become one of the world's great ancient celebrities, Tutankhamun. King Tut. Just as they did in 1922, people flock to see Tut's tomb. But few among them have heard of KV-60, or the many others of the small and undecorated sort. My own first visit to the Valley of the Kings was on a scorching hot July afternoon in 1981, 8 years before I would encounter Tomb 60. I rented a dilapidated bicycle on the west bank of the Nile, across from the modern town of Luxor, and traveled a road headed straight west along green fields before turning north past two immense seated stone statues, which are most of what is left of the mammoth mortuary temples of the great pharaoh Amenhotep III. Pedaling by the village of Gurna, with its mud-brick houses built among the tombs of an ancient cemetery, I biked a long, uphill stretch through a dry, winding ravine. The heat reflecting from the asphalt road added to the strenuous misery of the ride, but eventually I reached the narrow entrance to the valley. Rows of closed souvenir kiosks reminded me that this remote place was very well known to tourists who had abandoned the scene earlier in the day to seek the cool refuge of their luxury hotels on the opposite side of the river. At midday, the valley was empty, except for a few tomb guards, Gafirs, napping in the shade. Tutankhamun's tomb was at the top of my agenda, and I walked immediately to the stone wall surrounding its entrance, so familiar to me from years of studying photographs. I wanted to experience the tomb as Howard Carter would have. As I entered the enclosure, a Gafir, clad in dark robes, sat up from his prone position and checked my ticket before resuming his slumber. I remember counting the steps. 16. As I descended to the spot where Carter had stood and observed an ancient door closed with plaster and stamped with the seal of the ancient necropolis, a jackal recumbent above 9 bound and kneeling captives. Carter would have then sent a telegram to his sponsor in England, Lord Carnarvon, and patiently awaited his arrival before the two breached the door together to find a tunnel filled with rubble, guarding another sealed door. I walked down this corridor and paused at the second doorway. Here is where Carter would have taken his first peek into the tomb that would make archaeological history. When Carnarvon asked if he could see anything through the small hole poked through the plastered door, Carter was said to have replied, "Wonderful thing." A prominent American Egyptologist, James Henry Breasted, who visited Tut's newly opened tomb, admits that he was utterly dazed by the overwhelming spectacle. The gorgeousness of the sight, the sumptuous splendor of it all, made it appear more like the confused magnificence of those counterfeit splendors which are heaped together in the property room of some modern grand opera than any possible reality surviving from antiquity. During my own visit, I saw that what Carter had found choked with a remarkable assortment of royal grave finery were only 4 tiny rooms. Their small size, a sobering dose of reality to many who visit the tomb for the first time. Since I had already personally viewed the magnificent assortment of artifacts retrieved from the tomb spread out over large halls in the Egyptian Museum in Cairo, it boggled my mind to think of this minuscule space housing them all. Off to the right of the room, a railed fence kept tourists back from the sunken burial chamber, in which a golden coffin, the outermost of Tut's nesting three, could be seen under a pane of glass. I have no idea how long I gazed at this token remainder of a dismantled royal burial. I wasn't aware of it at the time, but the pathetically damaged mummy of the young pharaoh remained hidden from view inside that very coffin as I looked on, stripped of its jewelry and other burial accoutrements by well-meaning archaeologists in the name of science. The naked remains lay in a tray of sand, a severed head and limbs placed in their proper anatomical position, as if to soothe the embarrassment of the mummy's exuberant investigators. The rest of the afternoon was spent investigating some of the larger tombs in the valley accessible to tourists, empty royal tombs with painted, carved walls that dazzle the imagination and confound the uninitiated with their esoteric symbolism. As closing time neared, I mounted my bike for the exhilarating, brakeless ride down the valley road to the fertile river plain. I returned to the valley a couple of years later, with a map in hand showing dots here and there accompanied by tomb numbers. My goal during this second visit was to see as many of the tombs as possible, if not to enter their interiors, then at least to locate their exteriors. After noting the obviously visible tombs with their wide gated doors, I spun my map about in confusion, wondering where many of the others might lie. To my surprise, about half of the tombs were identifiable only by little shafts or holes, while others could not be seen at all. I went yet again to the valley the following year, this time well equipped with a comprehensive knowledge of the area as a whole. My preparation had been a magnificent research volume titled The Royal Necropolis of Thebes, written by an Egyptologist named Elizabeth Thomas in 1966. The book had never been formally published, but its single-spaced typewritten pages had been printed and assembled into a mere 90 copies to be found in scattered libraries. Thomas had collected nearly every known tidbit of information on the valley and other royal cemeteries in the region. There was very little that she missed, and her footnotes contain many references to archival notes by explorers and archaeologists. Something of interest can be found on every page, and I was struck not only by what was known, but by what was not. Each tomb had something special and fascinating about it, and I discovered details of the obscure tombs that had piqued my interest from my previous tour of the valley. In the old days of Egyptian archaeology, finding a tomb or more a day might be de rigueur, and a robber-ravaged burial with nothing of artistic value was hardly worth a yawn. Yet, the very existence of these many unpainted tombs speaks of their significance. Since the discovery of the tomb of Tutankhamun, very little archaeological excavation had taken place in the Valley of the Kings. While there had been studies of the funerary texts on the walls of some of the large royal tombs, the assumption seemed to be that there was little left to be found. An expedition from the Brooklyn Museum broke that trend in 1977 by spending a few years excavating a huge shaft in the tomb of Ramses XI and conducting some useful conservation studies. A dozen years later, I would apply to investigate a series of the anonymous tombs located behind a prominent hill in the valley. They seemed to form a group, and the information I had about each was truly compelling. Each had its number: 21, 27, 28, 44, and 45, and all but 21 were visible as shafts, open or otherwise. The general area of 21, the largest of the five, could be discerned from a map, but its specific location was paved over by rubble, most likely brought by a combination of flash floods and dumping on the site by early excavators. I wrote to Elizabeth Thomas, with my idea of investigating the small, ignored tombs, and she presented me with a suggestion. As I would be working in the vicinity, why not see if I might be able to locate an enigmatic, undecorated grave known as Tomb KV-60? It was supposed to be located in the vicinity of KV-19, which belonged to a 20th dynasty prince by the name of Montuhir Kopachev. I had no interest. There were four tombs with known locations to keep me plenty busy, in addition to uncovering and studying Tomb 21. Besides, the location of Tomb 60 was nowhere immediately apparent. It was, however, a very interesting burial. The discovery was made in the spring of 1903, as described briefly by Howard Carter in an article published the following year. A small, uninscribed tomb, immediately in the entrance of number 19, Tomb of Montuhir Kopachev. It consists of a very rough flight of steps leading down to a passage of 5 meters long, ending in a low and rough square chamber, about 4 by 5 meters, which contained the remains of a much-destroyed and rifled burial. Nothing was in this tomb but two much-denuded mummies of women and some mummied geese. One of the mummies was lying in the lower portion of its coffin, lid missing, the other on the floor beside it. Their heads were fairly well preserved and had long hair of golden color. I should say that they must have been elderly people. The burial had probably been robbed by the workmen when making the tomb of Montuhir Kopachev. The portion of the coffin containing the mummy had been stripped of its outer molding, possibly on account of its being gilded, and the only inscription of value that could be made out was the following name and title: The Royal Nurse. In. Mr. Newberry was present at the opening, and he thinks that possibly these were the mummies of the nurses of Thuthmes IV. I reclosed the tomb, only removing the geese. In retrospect, the description of the tomb would seem sufficient to cause any modern archaeologist a major twinge of excitement. Yet, Carter's comments suggest almost a casual disinterest in this remarkable discovery. The tomb description appears as a couple of paragraphs in a lengthy article in which Carter describes his work in Upper Egypt for the years 1902 to 1903. During that time, he also excavated at the mortuary temple of Ramses II, the Ramesseum, inspected the work of various archaeologists, made repairs to temples, excavated the dangerous tomb of Thutmose I and Hatshepsut in the Valley of the Kings, discovered the marvelous royal tomb of Thutmose IV, and, oh yes, an undecorated tomb of minor interest in the vicinity, containing two female mummies. Carter, at the time, had been contracted to do some archaeological work for the eccentric American millionaire Theodore Davis. Davis, an amateur archaeologist, hired Carter to conduct excavations on his behalf in the Valley of the Kings. Davis had the concession to dig wherever he chose in the Sacred Valley, and despite his armchair background, he was exceedingly successful in uncovering some wonderfully provocative tombs. He was also responsible for finding a cache of embalming materials belonging to a then-obscure pharaoh named Tutankhamun, a discovery that provided evidence that the king's burial was yet to be found somewhere in the valley. When a small tomb was discovered in 1907, Davis concluded that this must be the woefully robbed tomb of the little-known king and moved on, although Carter himself remained skeptical. If Howard Carter's notes regarding KV-60 are brief, Theodore Davis himself has even less to say about the experience. During the season of 1904 to 1905, Mr. Carter, while excavating for Mr. Davis, dug a trench across the entrance to this tomb and discovered a tomb of the 28th dynasty, over which the tomb of Mantuhirkhopachev had been cut. This earlier burial he found to contain the mummies of two women. The tomb had been plundered and contained nothing of interest. The words, "nothing of interest," certainly confirm the early 20th century attitude about the smaller tombs, an attitude so blasé that the wrong year was given in Davis's description of the find. Just a month or two before he encountered Tomb 60, Howard Carter discovered in the same vicinity the large, decorated, and looted tomb of the great 18th dynasty pharaoh, Thutmose IV. In fact, an old rope, likely used by robbers 3,000 years ago, was found tied to a pillar in order to facilitate the crossing of a deep shaft, and a large, ancient, cursive graffito records an inspection of the tomb after the robbery. Though the tomb was robbed in antiquity, there was an impressive residual collection of battered burial debris found along with the pharaoh's magnificent stone sarcophagus, sans mummy, that decorated the spacious burial chamber. Given the prevailing outlook of the day and the continual search for more significant discoveries, it is not surprising that Tomb 60 drifted quickly into obscurity. Carter closed the tomb, probably filling it with the debris of continuing excavations. But its history was far from over. The tomb was likely entered 3 years later, in 1906, by another excavator, Edward Ayrton, while he was in the process of excavating KV-19. We know of this visit only indirectly through a handwritten notation in the Egyptian Museum's inventory catalog, the Journal d'Entrée, which records the acquisition of a coffin with a mummy, recognized by Carter as having been found by him near Mantuhirkhopachev in 1903. It was brought away later by Ayrton. No mention was made of the second mummy in the tomb, found lying on its floor. Might it and other burial remnants still remain within? Sometime, perhaps immediately, after this second modern visit to the tomb, KV-60 became once again buried and its specific location lost, destined to remain obscure for another 80 years. As Carter noted, the mummy in Cairo retrieved by Ayrton was initially identified by hieroglyphs on the coffin in which she lay. Yet, later research revealed that she was not the nurse of Pharaoh Thutmose IV, but rather served that role for Hatshepsut, the controversial woman who ruled over Egypt for about 20 years. Her name was Sitre, daughter of the god Re, and her nickname was In, fish. A shattered statue of this woman was discovered at the site of Hatshepsut's temple, on the other side of the cliffs from the valley, and depicts her seated with the young queen-slash-pharaoh-to-be seated on her lap. The location of Tomb 60 would perhaps seem to make sense then, because the closest royal tomb of the appropriate date was indeed that of Hatshepsut, nearby. Out of respect for Elizabeth Thomas, I added KV-60 to my list of requests to be submitted for approval to the Egyptian Antiquities Authorities. If the situation presented itself sometime during the next few years, perhaps I would spend a moment contemplating the location of this long-missing tomb. The scenario, as it played out, however, would be quite different. It was late June 1989 when we arrived in Luxor to begin our work on the valley's undecorated tombs, and the intense summer heat had already arrived a couple of months before. We spent a day getting established, negotiating a reasonable long-term rate with our hotel manager, and rounding up the supplies we would need to begin work. I was accompanied by one of my former professors, Mark Papworth, a brilliant thinker, and the unsung...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?